Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine and America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Barry Wine, who is a former lawyer and legendary chef. Barry was a chef and owner of the Quilted Jar, which opened in 1975 and successfully operated for 18 years. And during that time, he was awarded rare 4 stars by the New York Times 3 times. The Quilted Jar is one of the most important restaurants in New York City history, along with Lutes, Four Seasons, Cirque, River Cafe, Windows on the World, Chanterelle, the San Domenico, and so on. Barry was also known for incorporating Japanese elements in his dishes and inspired many prominent chefs in this country, including David Kinch of the 3-star Michelin restaurant Manresa in California, who joined us on episode 66. So today we'll discuss Barry's unique career path, how he got into Japanese cuisine, and how he expressed the essence of Japanese cuisine at the Quilted Jar, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan is available on Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as podcasts. Please go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe to Japan Eats. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org. And finally, many of you have asked where to dine in Japan. So I just uploaded a list of our recommendations on our website. If you're interested, please go to heritageradionetwork.org/where-to-dine-in-japan. It's all connected with hyphen. heritageradionetwork.org/where-to-in-japan. So please enjoy. And now let's start our conversation with Barry Wine. Hello, Barry. Welcome to Japanese.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
So,
thanks for that very nice introduction.
Well, you're a very special person, so I was looking forward to the show today. So where are you from? What did you eat when you grew up? That's the first question.
I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it was very famous for Schlitz beer.
Okay.
But as a young person, I was drinking, eating pizza. Mm. I was eating fish fry, which is a very Milwaukee kind of thing. My family ate out for dinner almost every night.
Wow.
Nobody in my family was a cook.
Wow. Interesting. So that's kind of, but you are really familiar with dining culture.
Well, at pizza restaurants at that time.
Okay. Right. And so I heard that you used to be a lawyer and worked at the law firm on Wall Street and had your own practice later. So how did you end up going into the culinary world?
I had moved right after the Woodstock Festival. I thought I was a hippie. So I moved very close to Woodstock, New York, in a small town called New Paltz. And there was not a lot to do on Saturday night, and I kept going to these auctions, and I kept buying too many things. And so I said to my wife, we have to have something else to do on Saturday, so we don't buy more things. And so I said, well, let's start a restaurant in this little house we owned. It was sort of close to the center of town. And originally the idea was that somebody else would own the restaurant. I would only be the landlord. But right at the last minute, this man who was a professor at the Culinary Institute backed out of the deal. So I said, oh, we have this house. We'd already built the kitchen. Why don't I become the owner of the restaurant?
Oh, wow. So, but you had any professional training?
No. I was very good at making lasagna. So for about a year, the restaurant ran with a chef who was hired from the CIA, but a recent graduate, very, very recent. So they weren't terribly well-trained yet. And one day I said to myself, I could do it as good as that guy. And so I started watching in the kitchen. One of the things that inspired me, there was a reporter from the Village Voice who came. And on that particular day, I had made the ice cream. It was blueberry ice cream. And he made a point in his review saying, oh, that was the best ice cream I've ever had.
Oh, my God.
And I said to myself, oh, I made that. So that got me started.
Wow. So, and eventually you moved to the Hakuide Giraffe, which was opened in 1975 to Manhattan in 1979, 4 years later. So was your dream becoming bigger or becoming more ambitious?
The dream was we were ready for the big time.
Okay.
So we opened very purposely around the corner from Lou Tess, although Lou Tess was on 50th Street, a beautiful street. We were on 2nd Avenue between an Irish pub on one side and a Korean grocery store on the other side. So people didn't at first understand we were trying to be just like Lou Tess.
So you were looking for not a bistro or a brasserie type of place, but something really fine dining?
Yes. And in fact, one of the goals of the Quilted Giraffe, the reason, well, it wasn't when we first opened it the first day, but it became clear that there were no restaurants in the United States, or virtually none, owned by Americans or restaurants that had American chefs, who were competing on the world stage. All the restaurants seemed to be French, and very few Americans got to work in those kitchens. The French wanted to hire the French cooks. So our goal was to create a restaurant every bit as good as Lou Tess, our neighbor, and to have it staffed, though, with young Americans. The whole time we did the restaurant, that was really the goal. And it was quite difficult because, unlike today, where it's very clear, if you're running Le Bernardin or David Boulay or any of the famous restaurants, you can hire an American who has worked somewhere else.
Right.
In 1979, no Americans really had the experience.
Right.
So we had to give them the experience.
But you believed in American talents at the time.
Oh, yes. You mentioned David Kinch. Tom Colicchio was another one of our famous alumni. Noel Comes, who started Tomcat Bakery, made breads for us. And then he went out and opened his own.
Wow. Okay. So really incredible. But that was the time. French equals fine dining. And the fine dining never would be Japanese sushi place. So that's a completely different world.
That's right. In those days, in fact, the first Americans who opened sushi restaurants, they always said, we're doing this to meet girls. and we want to make a more romantic-looking place. Most Japanese restaurants in the early 1980s had fluorescent lights, and they were not very sexy.
No. It's like operation room something.
In those, yeah. So the first Americans who started doing Japanese things had that goal.
Interesting. Okay, and so what kind of menu did you offer at the Quilted Giraffe? Because I heard you surprised New Yorkers with really fresh new ideas.
Doing something new and interesting and creating I'll call it an interactive experience, serving a tasting menu before anybody else did that. So eventually we served a kaiseki menu, and every dish was in every plate, every dish we served was on a different plate. And if you were having a tasting menu, sitting at this table, and next door, somebody at the next table, somebody was having a tasting menu.
Mm.
They had different plates.
Wow.
And if you had a tasting menu this week and you came back next week, we made a point to give you a whole new set of dishes.
Mm.
So we were always inventing.
Right.
And we tried to invent it so that if you were wearing red shoes, I would give you a dinner that had something to do with red.
Oh, wow.
And if you were, after a while, we started having a lot of Japanese customers. If you were from a certain place in Japan, I would try and give you plates that I had bought in that city.
Wow. It's almost like even now, many restaurants are doing it. Maybe 11 Marison Park, that kind of really obsessively, meticulously service-oriented and doing interesting ideas. So it's very impressive.
That was our goal.
Right. Okay. But by the way, so all the dishes came and developed by you? Or the team, or how did you come up with all those new ideas?
We had a very sort of cooperative idea in the kitchen.
Mm.
And I was willing to let all the cooks experiment.
Mm.
They could use as much food as they want and develop a dish. And maybe at staff dinner every night, somebody would cook dinner or say, oh, I want you to taste this. And it was very, very open to a collaboration, I guess would be the right
sounds
word.
Like Airbnb was something very forward-minded, experimental place.
Yes.
Wow, that's amazing. And maybe you can tell us some signature dishes.
Well, the restaurant's most famous dish, and it's still served today, and people remember it, both because of how it tastes and how we served it, was called the Beggar's Purse.
Mm.
The Beggar's Purse is a crepe filled with caviar and creme fraiche, sort of folded up like a hobo's purse in Mark Twain holding something over your shoulder and a stick. And sometimes we served it for years and years, all the time. It was very expensive. It was $15 a bite.
Mm.
And it was a eat it all in one piece.
Wow. It's even now, it could be a little...
It'll probably be more. The cost of caviar is probably more today.
Right.
And the thing that made it particularly interesting is, and this is part of the idea of the Quilted Giraffe being entertainment for the customer as well as food,
right.
We served it on a pedestal, and very often I or the waiters would, as we delivered the beggar's purse to somebody, we'd say, put your hands behind your back and lean over and just grab the beggar's purse off the pedestal and eat it in one bite.
Right.
Eventually, as we got braver and it became more fun, we got handcuffs. And we handcuffed you to the back of the chair or to a light fixture on the wall.
Mm.
And I have thousands and thousands of pictures of customers enjoying their beggar's purse. And, for example, I have pictures of Warren Beatty. And he brought all of his friends. He brought Madonna.
Mm.
He brought Dustin Hoffman. And I have 25 pictures of Warren Beatty eating beggar's purses, having a good time.
I wish there was an Instagram already at that time.
Yeah.
Okay. And also, you one of the pioneers to practice the farm-to-table philosophy by using your local ingredients as much as possible, and even you grew your own ingredients. So why was it that another way to make the Quilted Giraffe like locally rooted American restaurant?
Yes, and we always had the house. The restaurant started in New Paltz. We had a country house in New Paltz, which I still own, which happens to be for sale,
okay.
And happens to be a place where we had a test kitchen.
Mm.
I have a pizza oven there, and of course, one of our most famous dishes was a pizza with tuna sashimi on it, and the base was creme fraiche, not cheese, wasabi flavored creme fraiche.
Wow!
John George serves it at both the Mercer Kitchen and at the Mark Hotel.
Mm. So really, you founded the Japanese-minded dishes in this country, I think.
Well, starting in about 1973, we had this idea. We were kind of doing nouvelle cuisine, the French nouvelle cuisine, and we were serving things on small plates.
Mm.
They were French plates or they were American plates, but customers started saying to me, calling me over to the table and saying, this looks very Japanese to us. It wasn't Japanese taste. It wasn't Japanese dishware. But they said, oh, I see the mountain and I see the river on your plate. And why the mashed potatoes was the mountain. Why don't you go to Japan? And if you do, I'll introduce you to some interesting people and you could learn. Right. And that's how it got started.
Wow. So that's the idea of mountain and water. That's the Sansei guy's old classic painting that really captures the moment of the nature. So that's usually incorporated into the dish, and you did it already without knowing.
Without knowing. Right. And so when I went to Japan, I got invited on my first trip, and this is really, I think, what made the whole difference, and I'm very thankful for it happened.
Mm. Who invited you?
One of our customers. A Japanese person. And he happened to love restaurants, to go to great restaurants. So I got to go to 3 Kichos.
Wow.
In Japan. And I had dinner with Mr. Tsuji.
Oh, my gosh.
At 2 of them.
Right. So listeners who are not familiar with Kichō Tsuji, Kichō is really one of the top restaurants, kaiseki restaurants in the whole country. And they have different locations. And Tsuji is like CIA. Tsuji Culinary Institute is the best culinary school in Japan. So,
yes. And even today, Mr. Tsuji has passed away. He wrote many cookbooks.
Right. I mean, the son is now leading, the first founder.
Yes. David Boulay has a very close relationship with the Tsuji Cooking School.
Right. But by the way, the founder, Mr. Tsuji, it was the first culinary book I ever read.
Ah!
And I might still have it. It's amazing.
I think I have it, too.
Mm.
And actually, after a couple years, my daughter, who was a high school graduate just right then, I arranged for her to go to cooking school in Osaka Mr. Tsuji's school.
Right.
And she did a homestay with some people. And
wow.
So over time, we got more and more interested.
Mm.
I've been to Japan 25 times.
Wow.
During those years. I went at least once a year and sometimes more often.
Wow.
And we were taken to wonderful restaurants that had very special dishes, lacquerware and ceramics and earthware. And I just got more and more interested and started going to the places where they made sake, places where they made dishes.
Mm.
And the more you know, the more you get interested in Japan, the more there is to learn.
Mm.
And you start learning what you don't know, and then you want to learn more. So right. it was quite good. We did that for 10 years.
Mm.
From 1983 to 1993.
Okay. Yeah, because when David Kinch of Mars came to our show and spoke on episode 66, he said Barry took a family vacation in Japan, and when he came back, he was a changed person. So it must be really a big impact on you. So what was the most memorable experiences, like, you know, some moments that changed your view to Japanese cuisine?
Well, I think it was seeing the dishware as part of the dinner.
Okay.
And there, I remember just extraordinary lacquer and going in the kitchen and seeing the owner of the restaurant washing the lacquer himself because it was so special.
Right.
And over time, as we collected more dishes, I found I was doing the same thing. I'd go in the dining room to pick up the dishes because I didn't want a waiter taking them and roughly putting them down on the dishwasher counter.
Mm.
And I handed it to somebody.
Right.
And we took good care of our dishes.
Because it's a piece of artwork.
Yes.
Right.
And the whole experience, and that's what we tried to essentially copy, was the special sense of it was a performance or it was a story that was being told. It was not just, here's the food today. Here's your food.
Mm.
Here's your bread.
Right.
Done.
Mm. So there is some sort of background, any age dish, what you serve and what you dislike or what you dislike elsewhere. Because the table is almost like a scenery in a way of the season.
Exactly. Mm. And we changed it. And I learned, you know, about using glass dishes in the summer and using more earthenware dishes in the middle of the winter.
Right.
And I still have that collection, which I have fun using.
Mm.
But at the time, we probably had, 30 or 40 sets of four or five dishes.
Wow. Sometimes
my favorite dish I would want to serve to somebody else in the dining room.
Mm.
So I'd it would be on one table, and I'd have to stall until I got the dishes back in the kitchen and got them washed and could give it to another table.
Right. Wow. Yeah, I think if you go to Kyoto Kaiseki restaurants especially, they're really into having a whole set of seasonal dishes. So they keep changing, and then they have a warehouse for the season. Right. So that's completely different, the world.
Completely.
Right. Versus porcelain. White porcelain in this country.
That's right.
Right.
And we were very interested in our flowers as well. And for some lucky reason, I guess, there were some very talented people who were the waiters in the restaurant, but who really wanted to be flower arrangers. So there were, I can think of a couple who we made them the florist for the restaurant, even though they had no professional experience being a florist.
Mm. So in other words, you hired like-minded people who's really sensitive to those aesthetic things.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And so what about, the whole culture? Like, dishes, place, that's great. But did you see anything? Like, culturally, Kaiseki cuisine mindset or the service, did you see anything else that you got inspired?
Well, one of my biggest teachers, and there was a gentleman named Norio Sumihara, who was going? He was going to anthropology school at NYU, and we made friends, and he liked the restaurant. And his family started inviting me to Japan, and literally taking me on trips with them.
Wow!
He was very involved in the religion Tenrikyo, and we'd have special parties where. One day it might be a sake party, or one day do you know Mito Koman?
Mm-hmm.
Was it a TV show?
Yeah, Mito Koman is like, there is an old man, really, shogun, like
that's
really
right.
high up person, but he's hiding his ID.
That's right. He puts his badge, he puts his hand up with the badge. And so we had he arranged a dress up party.
Okay.
And we all wore. costumes. I think they'd been borrowed from a movie studio, so they were. And I had the haircut, the Japanese haircut, the samurai. And I think maybe on your website, you have that picture.
Yes, show page that varies in samurai outfit.
yeah. So it was things like that that the Sumihara family just showed me so many things that. You would not ordinarily get to see.
Mm.
I think that's what the special thing of our going to Japan. It was just this lucky that our clientele became more and more Japanese because those were the years that Japan was trying to become much more internationalized, buying real estate in New York, learning what Chateau Lafitte Rothschild was, learning about things of that sort. And we were the wonderful place for a Japanese businessman to bring an American businessman to show something about Japan, but at the same time, for an American businessman to bring a Japanese businessman to show what was taking place in America and how we were starting to understand Japanese food.
Right, so it's like a mutual, common, reaching place for powerful businessmen or culturally... very sophisticated people.
Yes. Those were the years where it was very, very obvious what was taking place.
Mm. Right, and there was a bubble economy in Japan too. So
that's
a lot
right.
of cultural things going on.
I think the customers even took me after work to a piano bars.
Oh, really?
So I could learn more about Japanese culture.
Oh, wow. Well, that was very heavy Japanese salaryman life. After dinner and bars. So you became part of it in New York.
I never learned karaoke. a good story is even Morimoto worked He didn't work when we had the restaurant, but when the restaurant closed in the end of 1992, the building was bought by Sony, and that's when we went out of business because they wanted to use our space.
Right.
So I was hired by Sony to work in the Sony Club, and the Sony Club had a very special 5-seat sushi bar, and we needed a chef. And so I went around New York looking at every Japanese restaurant to see who might become the sushi chef.
Right.
And surprisingly, in a not very special restaurant, I found Morimoto.
Mm.
And he came and worked at the restaurant.
Right. That was after he worked for Nobu?
No, he worked for us. I'd have to say we discovered him.
Ah, okay.
And one of the fun stories is one day I had invited Drew Nieperant, who's involved in Nobu, to come see how nice our sushi bar was.
Mm.
And pretty soon after that, he hired
Morimoto. So incubator. Yeah, but then he loves karaoke, so that's something.
That's what made me think of it. I've been with him. He's very good at karaoke.
I heard.
And he's very philosophical, Morimoto. So
right.
He's one of the, I enjoy the fact that I worked with him.
Right. Yeah, Chef Morimoto really tried to, kind of like, behaving funny, but he's such a very deep-minded person, big thinker.
Even when he's doing karaoke.
Right. I have to listen. Okay. Hopefully I get a chance. Okay. Let's take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk about how Barry transformed a quilted drop after the trip to Japan. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Barry Wine, who is a former lawyer and one of the legendary chefs in New York. And Barry was the chef and owner of the Quilted Giraffe, which opened in 1975 and successfully operated for 18 years. During that time, he was awarded the rare 4 stars by the New York Times 3 times. So we talked about your trip to Japan, and I heard you really changed the menu and the concept. I mean, not the whole thing, probably, but I heard quite a lot of things happen. So what was the change?
Well, we started using the Japanese dishes. At the beginning, maybe I didn't have very many, maybe only about 1 set in Japan, put it in my suitcase and brought it back. As if you remember, maybe your audience remembers, in those days, there was no fine sake in New York. There was just 4 or 5 brands. They came in double-sized bottles, magnum-sized bottles, I guess 1,500 liters. And it wasn't until much, much later that we started to be able to buy fine sake in New York. So on every trip, I would buy 12 bottles and put them in my suitcase and bring them back and save them for a special occasion. I started to understand the idea. The nicer the dishes were, if they were lacquer, for example, you wouldn't want to use a knife and a fork. So the Quilted Giraffe was serving French food with chopsticks.
Oh, my God. Really? Wow.
And just all the time, one more thing got added after every trip. I learned something. We started to have a collection of sake cups. And I started to learn that the fish always streams, a fish always goes upstream. Mm. So when I had to put it on the plate, I had to make it going upstream. Mm. And the cooks in the kitchen just had never heard of things of that sort. So it was always learning and teaching and explaining. We started to import fish from Japan. Mm. Today it's normal to see that in sushi bars and even in fine restaurants. But at the time, we were probably the first customer for the kind of company that flew fish over every day.
Right, and especially non-Japanese restaurants, right?
That's right. We had Wagyu early on. We even had Fugu. And I have a certificate. It's kind of silly.
Really?
Because I was not really a Fugu chef who could clean a Fugu.
Right.
But I got a certificate.
Wow.
But the fish had been brought over frozen. Mm. So there was no risk that somebody would die from
our Fugu. Well, did you get the license to remove the poison in Japan? Or
No. We're buying the frozen Fugu where the poison was already gone.
Right. Okay. But all those changes, I know that you have a lot of regular customers. So what was their reaction to your change?
Oh, I think they sort of got excited by it. And they knew the next time they came back, it would not be the same. Mm. That truly was one of the fun parts of the quilted giraffe. There was either a seasonal vegetable. And, these were the days when if you could only buy strawberries in season.
Mm.
So today we can get them year-round. But because we had the farm in New Paltz, we were able to start to... We had a car and a walk-in refrigerator, which is still in my house, which is for sale. and we had a farmer. And we'd grow things. And in the early days, Michel Gérard, the French chef, was one of the... people had a great influence on me.
Mm.
And he would serve a dish called leg of lamb baked in hay. It's in his cookbook.
Mm.
And I've been to his restaurant 3 or 4 times. And he has a big garden as well.
Mm.
So I said to myself, well, why don't we serve leg of lamb cooked in corn husks?
Mm.
Which is, again, very American.
Right.
And we could get it at our farm when we drove up to New Paltz to get things. And that's how things came about.
Right.
The French, when you went to France in the summer, you could eat for dessert fraise de bois, the little wild strawberries.
Mm-hmm.
Can't buy them in the store.
Mm-hmm.
They take forever to pick. To pick one pint of them might take an hour. But we started growing them in the farm in New Paltz.
Mm.
And so we started incorporating all these elements, the dishware, the flowers, the seasonal foods, the imported fish.
Mm.
And at one point, Gail Green wrote a story. And she called me the best Japanese chef in New York, which I thought was pretty funny.
Well, no surprise, though, because the philosophy is really there. Even if maybe some dishes look like non-kaiseki style. But speaking of, what kind of Japanese-influenced dishes did you serve?
Well, we started using more and more ingredients. The tuna sashimi pizza with wasabi.
Yeah,
creme fraiche.
I wish I could taste that. Sounds great.
At one point, we decided we should maybe try making sushi, but wanting to do something new, we made mashed potato sushi.
Mm.
Instead of the rice, we used mashed potatoes, not hot, cold enough that they'd kind of stick together. I remember buying a device that lets you make a rose in the middle of a flower in the middle of the maki roll without really knowing how to do it.
Right.
Just the roller did it for you. And so we made this mashed potato sushi with a flower in the middle.
Wow, that makes sense. Yeah. Right. But the mashed potato itself was, what kind of flavor was it?
It tasted like mashed potatoes.
Oh, okay. So no vinegar, nothing.
No. It's just the idea of a maki roll.
Right.
You remind me, on one of the trips, I met a very famous Japanese chef named Mikuni.
Mm.
And there's a restaurant in Tokyo called Hotel de Mikuni.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a cookbook, and he was serving things that I thought kind of represented what we were doing, unusual Japanese food.
Right.
And so we invited him to New York. He came, he spent a week, and we gave him our menu, but he made it even more Japanese, which was fun. He brought a TV crew with him, and it became a one-hour show on Sunday night, I think on maybe Channel 4 in Japan is the very popular channel.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of Japanese people had seen that. A lot of Japanese, trying to remember, there was a TV show called Love Story, and a very handsome man and very good-looking woman. But it was Love Story New York, I think, was the name of the story. And they came and filmed at the restaurant.
Wow.
I think there was a very funny woman named Pink, a comedian maybe. She came and filmed at the restaurant.
Mm.
So over time, these things kind of build on themselves.
Right.
And the expectations for us were higher and made us work harder. We'd always be looking for the newest thing.
Right. And then you served a $135 Japanese tasting menu. So was it like a kaiseki cuisine style?
Yes. In fact, we called it New York kaiseki.
Mm.
I have a big collection of, I call it the archives.
Mm.
Because we had the country house, we had plenty of room for saving things. And we just saved every time the restaurant got in a story, in a newspaper, letters from customers, all kinds of things like that. And I have all those things. And I look back on them today, and I can see over year to year to year how things got more and more sophisticated.
Wow, interesting. So, in other words, I hope that Japanese elements kept you kind of thinking all the time, because you have to have something completely different angle, right? Because an American Western cuisine is really deep, but Japanese angle, you have to really see differently.
And there's the culture that comes with it. It's not only the taste. And, you know, whether you want to say this is important for a restaurant or not, I remember going to Kicho. And you sat in a tatami room. Everybody was in a different tatami room. And if you wanted to go to the bathroom, the person who was waiting on you said, oh, just a minute, I have to go look that nobody else is in the hallway, because we don't want anybody to see anybody else.
Mm.
So if I suppose somebody might be there with his girlfriend, and they don't want to be seen. But that kind of attention to detail, I thought was really special.
Mm.
We started doing things like, we got a CD called Japanese Airport.
Okay.
And it made those sounds that, if you've been to the Japanese airport, those ding, ding, ding. and so we played that in the bathroom.
Mm.
And we started just doing all these little details that you might see in a very, very fine restaurant in Japan. And that, of course, was very unusual in the United States. And I think a whole bunch of cooks and people who owned restaurants would come and see it. We got a lot of publicity. And eventually, I think we were the beginning of what's developing in the Japanese restaurant world, or American restaurants being a little more Japanese, like you say, 11 Madison Park.
Right. So that's the whole package, not just the dining, but the whole experience. Kind of like part of your life. It's different, that moment of dining.
That's right. I started wearing a Japanese chef's jacket after a while.
Oh, wow.
Stopped wearing the French-style chef's jacket.
Well, if you can find the picture, I'll post it on the show page, too.
Okay.
Right. So the Kyoto Giraffe was in operation for over 18 years. Until the Sony Corporation bought out your lease, like you said earlier. So why do you think the restaurant is so successful and lasted such a long time?
We worked very hard. It was my wife at the time. And I, she was at the front door. I was in the kitchen. We very much coordinated the timing of the food. I was a stickler. I was maybe too tough on everybody. Mm. We wanted exactly 10 minutes between courses. And we served a lot of multi-course dinners. But if you didn't do that, dinner might take 3 or 4 hours, and our feeling was people didn't want that.
Right.
So to keep it moving exactly on schedule, we had these digital clocks. And it was very hard on everybody who worked there to... It wasn't relaxed. It looked relaxed, looked very relaxed to the customer, but it was very much based on we want to do this exactly the right way.
Mm.
We started cutting the food in very small pieces, kind of in the Chinese style of wok cooking, so that everything could cook in 3 or 4 minutes. We only had maybe one or two things on the menu that were roasts.
Mm.
Everything else was in the pan. Like scallops, for example,
right.
Or shrimp, or small pieces of meat.
Mm.
And those were the things that made it possible to be right out of the pan, right onto the plate, right to the customer, within, you know, exact 1 minute from the kitchen to the customer. So it was perfect.
Right. Well, actually, you know, the aforementioned David Kinch of Marissa, he's got a great, beautiful cookbook. And one the chapter said Barry's approach to running a kitchen was as different as his food. The kitchen was incredibly organized, efficient, and clean. And it was also unusually quiet. And so also he said he attracted free thinkers like himself and always wanted to know what they thought about the dish or ingredient. And Barry didn't allow his ego to get in the way of running the best restaurant in the city or trying dishes or techniques that would be unthinkable in a rigid French kitchen. So that's who you are.
I'm very proud of David. And many, many, many people who worked at the restaurant have gone on to very good careers in food.
Well, you mentioned earlier you have a lot of great graduates. So, yeah, you influence. And I think I'm very grateful that you really create a foundation of Japanese cuisine for those talented chefs in this country. So, thank you. And what do you think you achieved through the success of the Quilted Chef, like personally or professionally?
Well, I think what we knew is to make this new kind of restaurant, not the old, the French, whether it was new French food, nouvelle cuisine, but there was still an attitude in the kitchen that one chef had learned from when he was growing up. He worked at 15 and somebody else, and there's a lot of shouting.
Mm.
And I call it, that was the brutal kitchen. It was like fighting. It wasn't a team effort.
Intimidating. So work for fear.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And if you read Eric Repair's recent book.
I'm curious about that.
It makes it very clear of some of the places he had worked before. Robuchon, for example.
Wow.
And I knew just instinctively that we couldn't have the kind of restaurant that we wanted unless we got rid of the brutal.
Mm.
We needed to make it a teamwork. Mm. We needed to make the waiters on the same side as the cooks and to respect the cooks and vice versa. So one of the things the restaurant also did, I'm very proud of, we were one of the first restaurants that had the service charge. And that was my idea of how to put everybody on the same team.
Mm. Wow, New York City just started doing it. So
yeah.
That was your founder of the idea. Right. Yeah, I think it's really the learning place that should be the kitchen, not like being a slave, scared, and tired. You cannot serve great food.
Right. But that was the tradition that we were breaking.
Mm.
And it's not that today every American restaurant is not brutal, mm-hmm. but there are many where there's no shouting in the kitchen. And again, Eric Ruppert is one of my favorite chefs, and he makes a point of how gentle he is, how he has changed from when he grew up to where he is today. And Le Bernardin is a more gentle place to work.
Mm. And by doing it, you gather knowledge, intellects from all those talented chefs. So that's a win-win situation.
That's right. Tom Colicchio, I think in his book, tells a story of how we used to cook duck one way. Mm. And then when he was working for us, one day he said, I have another way to cook duck. Do you mind if I show you? Mm. And he showed us. And of course, his way was better.
Right.
So from then on, we cooked his way. Mm. So it was that kind of feeling inside the kitchen.
Mm. So grow together.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
And that's partially because I was not trained, so I was very happy to learn.
Mm.
But we didn't want to learn the bad things. And I had a good feeling of what I did not want to learn.
Mm. Right. Yeah, I saw other comments. Because you are not professionally trained, you exceeded that by John Brumbaum.
Mm-hmm.
Your graduate when we graduate.
Yes.
He said that too. And so many other comments I read that people really appreciated not having that rigid French training that really made you successful too. So, okay. And so you introduced Japanese cuisine through the Quilted Draft to many New Yorkers, and now you see a lot of more Japanese elements in American dining scenes. But how do you predict the future of Japanese cuisine in America?
Getting more expensive.
That is for sure.
In New York, we see so many $185 tasting menus or mm-hmm. $235 tasting mm-hmm. menus. And it's almost like anybody thinks they can do that. But my advice to people is that it's not only the food. It's not the precision of the food. It's that, but it's a lot more. It's the hospitality.
Mm.
It's the visual. The using the better dishware makes the customer have a better time.
Mm.
And for us, it really is about entertaining the customer.
Mm.
Not only feeding the customer, but entertaining the customer. And I find that missing today in many places, even the expensive ones.
Mm.
It's just like a machine. They serve something. It might be a counter restaurant, and they don't talk to you.
Mm.
Well, who wants to go to a sushi bar when the sushi chef doesn't want to talk to you?
Right, exactly. So. Right, missing the point of sitting at the counter.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And I think sushi chefs are trained to have a conversation in Japan. As far as it's a good restaurant, they're really like, without losing a quality, they're trained to talk and explain and educate you.
And what we haven't seen yet, but I remember so much from Japan, is what you call a kappo restaurant, where it's a counter restaurant, but it's not sushi. It's
it's a little more casual.
But it's not izakaya. It's
right.
It could be kaiseki level in a kappo restaurant.
The food itself is, but you can request, I feel like eating this, and they serve you this.
That's right.
And whereas ryote, that's another form of kaiseki, but ryote is, you have a garden. That's, I heard. I love
and a lantern.
Right. Yeah, so if you see the garden lantern, it's a ryote, and it's way more expensive even.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So your kappo is a good name to know, because I feel like going couple restaurant in Japan.
But we haven't had a lot of that yet.
Mm, no, I don't think even people know the name. We don't use that here. Right.
So maybe it's couple masa.
But it's
not the style, though, is not that.
Where
you're sitting across from somebody cooking for you in person.
It's very intimate.
Yes. Right. Yes.
So would you like to open another restaurant?
I don't want to open another restaurant, but that is what I would want to do. Okay. Exactly what I would want to do.
Maybe you sell the New Paul's house and then become the investor for a new couple restaurant.
Or have a teaching school in my country house.
Right.
To somebody who wants to do that. Because it's got a wonderful, wonderful kitchen, the pizza oven, the walk-in refrigerator, and the garden.
Wow. So where can I find you? Our listeners who's interested. Once in a while about you, what's the where can I find you?
My email is barrywine@eatcaviar.com.
Oh.
And I think I started doing that because of the beggar's purse. I've had that email address a very long time. I also own drinksake.com.
Perfect. And your name is Barry Wine, so.
That's right. And I am on Facebook.
Okay.
And I think if somebody wants to be my friend, better to write me and say, I've asked to be your friend. Can you do it? It's not that I'm fussy.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to kind of know who my friends are.
Right.
Before I say yes.
Right strategy. Yeah. Right. So write through Facebook, the message?
Yes.
Okay.
No, they can write to me in barrywine@eatcaviar.com.
I never forget the name.
I'm asking your... I asked you on Facebook to be friends.
Okay.
And then I'll make you my friend.
All right. So listen, that's barrywine@eatcaviar.com. Yep. All right. So thank you so much for joining us today, Barry.
Well, it was fun.
So, listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japaneseats@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, the iTunes and Stitcher podcast. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We appreciate your feedback. And today's show is made possible by Corin, and our engineer was Vitoro Hash. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.